of a foolish outlaw. John Dillinger was his name. He became a vicious killer and lived a life of shame. Decent people feared this menace since 1924. But his mad career is ended, and he'll never kill no more.
John Dillinger became a legendary figure soon after he began robbing banks in 1933, inspiring records like this one, Outlaw John Dillinger by the Frank Luther Trio. His life has inspired a number of motion pictures, most recently Public Enemy, starring Johnny Depp. But how close is Johnny Depp's bank robber to the real Dillinger, and how much is he based on the Dillinger myth? Elliot J. Gorn can clear that up. He has written a book called Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One. It's published by Oxford University Press, and it brings Elliot Gorn to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Was John Dillinger America's first public enemy number one?
Well, he was the nation's first public enemy number one. That concept, the idea of a public enemy, really comes out of Chicago, out of the Chicago Crime Commission. And Dillinger, and actually after him, after he dies, several members of his gang are in succession until they're finally rounded up, become public enemies number one.
But he's the only one that we remember from this time. There have been many most wanteds who've been forgotten. Why does this man who died over 70 years ago continue to be remembered?
75 years ago, a week from today, actually, July 22nd. I think there are a lot of reasons. There were men who stole more. There were criminals who certainly were responsible for more deaths. There was something about Dillinger that was deeply charismatic. That was part of it. There's also something about the story that has to do with the Great Depression that's very important. Dillinger robbed banks, and in the middle of the Great Depression, in 1933-34, upwards of 10,000 banks had closed their doors, and many Americans were very angry about this. They saw this as the real form of robbery. Anyone who struck back at the banks had at least the potential to be seen as someone who was, if not a public benefactor, someone who was doing something really not that bad.
But he didn't begin as a bank robber. Why did he turn to crime in the first place?
He ended up in the Indiana State Penitentiary for 9 years for an assault on an old man. Dillinger's father thought that young Johnny should plead guilty, throw himself on the mercy of the court. And when he did, he was given this extremely long sentence. He served 9 years. And
he was just 21 at the time?
He was 21 years old. He certainly was a high-strung kid, but he didn't have much of a record of crime or antisocial behavior. But he came out well-versed in how to do it. He met and became friends with guys who really knew what was going on the outside, how to find fences, how to identify banks. He sprung them out of jail, smuggled some guns into them, and the Dillinger gang, by the summer of 1933, was off and running.
So a judge made him an example and actually created a serious criminal.
I think that's fair to say.
He began robbing banks, as you say, soon after he was released, and that's where your story really starts. When he was paroled in the heart of the Depression, did he ever consider going straight?
He says he did, and the story is that he did. If that's true, it would have been awfully difficult. Again, 25% unemployment when he gets out in the spring of 1933, a man with a criminal record. His father had moved to the town of Mooresville, rural Indiana. The countryside was devastated by the Great Depression. His chances of making it in the straight world really were remarkably small.
Why did Dillinger and his gang only target Midwestern banks near Indiana? Didn't that make him an easier target for law enforcement?
No, not at all. They ranged some, really, from Ohio all the way out to through Wisconsin. They had a range of several hundred miles. The idea basically was to be on borders of towns, borders of states, where jurisdictional disputes would keep the authorities from following you until the federal government finally got involved late in the day in 1934.
They didn't commit crimes when they vacationed in Florida, but they were captured at one point in Tucson, Arizona. How did they wind up there?
We don't really know. We know that it had gotten pretty hot for them in Chicago, that they headed down to Florida in December of 1933. This must have been so exotic for these folks. They were all from the Midwest, especially from Indiana, working class people. Dillinger, his gang, their girlfriends. Florida must Daytona Beach must have just seemed so exotic. And then they headed across the country all the way to Tucson, Arizona, again to the desert of the Southwest. Again, this must have been the sense of freedom of the open road for men who had all been confined to prison for years. It must have been so exhilarating. We don't know that they committed robberies there. We don't know whether they were planning them or not. Some say that that's the reason they went to Tucson, was that there was possibly a big score there and then across to Mexico, but we'll never know.
Well, you've given your book the title Dillinger's Wild Ride, the year that made America's public enemy number one. So all of this took place in just 1 year?
Just over a year, yeah. Basically, from the time that his friends get out of the Indiana State Penitentiary, break out, until the time Dillinger dies is actually less than a year.
How much money did he actually steal during that time?
Something over $300,000, roughly $5 million in today's currency.
But when his father claimed his son's body, the only money returned to him was $7.
And that's controversial. Dillinger's sister said that her brother always carried a lot of money on a money belt that was missing. There is reason to think that when people, as the phrase was in the 30s, put him on the spot, fingered him, they also managed to steal whatever it was he had.
How was he able to break out of jail a number of times? I would have thought after the first time they would have kept a close eye on him.
Yeah, you would think so. There was the first breakout where he managed to smuggle guns in bins of thread. He and his friends had worked in the shirt shop. It was a for-profit prison business. And he managed to smuggle with some aid, smuggle guns in there. Now, just as he did that, he himself, Dillinger, was on the outside. He had been arrested, was sitting in jail in Lima, Ohio. When his friends got out, they robbed a bank, procured some money and some guns, went to Lima, and sprang Dillinger.
A little different than the way it was portrayed in the film Public Enemies.
Yeah, the film gives you opens with a very dramatic scene of Dillinger getting his friends out of prison, and he wasn't there. He was sitting in prison himself, actually. But then the most interesting jailbreak after he's arrested in Tucson. In March of 34, he manages to procure a wooden gun. He claimed he carved it himself, but he probably didn't. And with that, to break out of the Crown Point Jail in Indiana.
My guest is Elliot J. Gorn, who teaches at Brown University and is the author of The Manly Art, Mother Jones, and co-author of A Brief History of American Sports. His latest is Dillinger's Wild Ride, the year that made America's public enemy number one. It's published by Oxford University Press. It's obvious you've seen the film, Public Enemies. Now, they change the story a bit, which is not surprising because Hollywood always does. But some of the things you cleared up for me was the nature of the relationship he had with Billy Frechette, who's played by Marion Cotillard in the film. The film blows it totally out of proportion. I guess they need to have an enduring love story in movies of this sort.
Dillinger had a few girlfriends in that year or so after he was out of prison, and I think Billy certainly was. I think they genuinely were very devoted to each other, and for as long as they were together, which was about six months, I think they genuinely were quite devoted. But this was a man who was hungry for life in every way. And though he apparently was deeply upset when Billy was arrested, thought very hard about trying to spring her from the FBI's grasp, and it just couldn't be done. But within a couple months, he has a new girlfriend, and it was with that girlfriend, Polly Hamilton, and Anna Sage, who became known as the Woman in Red. He accompanied them to the movie theater, the Biograph Theater here in Chicago. And it was walking out, as the three of them were walking out, the newspaper said arm in arm, that the FBI was waiting and shot him down in the street.
The FBI promised Anna Sage that she wouldn't be deported if she squealed on John Dillinger, but she wound up being deported anyway, wasn't she? In fact, I gather she's now the subject of real interest in Romania.
She has been off and on. It's interesting. The movie probably gets it right that Melvin Purvis didn't make promises, that he said he would do his best, and that's probably right. But yes, she does end up being deported not too long after Dillinger's death.
Now, what about the impression that we get from the film that Dillinger was kind of a reluctant criminal at times, that he's persuaded to commit more crimes by his accomplices? I mean, he comes across as a man who's in love, who can't resist pulling off just one more robbery.
It's hard to know if that's true. I don't think there's a lot of evidence of that sort of thing. Another person who's written about Dillinger, William Helmer, said that Dillinger was crooked but not twisted, which is a kind of a nice way to put it. The man, he's not a sociopath. He's not a psychopath. He's this very interesting character, charismatic. There's something about him that's strangely likable. He's charming in a way. He has a certain elan. He has a certain style about him. And he really knows how to play for the cameras. If you ever see, and it's replicated in the film, if you ever see that moment when he gets to Crown Point and after this 24-hour journey from Tucson, six flight legs and finally a car entourage, an automobile entourage, bringing him to Crown Point, and the first thing he does is put his arm around the prosecuting attorney who is going to try to send him to the electric chair. And this is photographed and filmed and goes out all over the country on newsreels and in newspapers. And he's smiling. He's smiling for the camera. You get a sense of the man from this.
Now, was Melvin Purvis really as much a Javert character as he's often portrayed?
Purvis is an enigmatic figure. I'm not sure. Certainly, Christian Bale is good casting for a film, but not accurate casting for Purvis. Purvis was actually, by the time Dillinger was brought down, Hoover had replaced Purvis effectively. He was still the special agent in charge of the Chicago office and nominally in charge of the investigation, but Hoover had basically surrounded him with others. It's Hoover, not Purvis, who brings in the Oklahomans and the Texans, the tough cops who finally shoot Dillinger. And it's Hoover who brings in Sam Cowley, who basically becomes the real head of the investigation, even as Purvis is still in place.
And the Dillinger case really helped J. Edgar Hoover's career, didn't it?
And Hoover knew it. Hoover too knew how to play publicity. In some ways, that's one of the reasons the two were such an interesting match. They're both very much about publicity. Hoover was on the verge of being fired. Dillinger had humiliated the FBI several times by escaping, escaping their clutches. When Hoover knew he had to bring him down, and when he did, when the agents did finally kill Dillinger, it's in dispute whether Dillinger was armed when he was shot. The FBI said yes. Eyewitnesses on Lincoln Avenue said no. But Hoover exploited that in terms of publicity over and over and over again in FBI. Sponsored radio and film. The image of Dillinger, of scientific policing, of good police work, of Dillinger being brought down and making the public safe is emphasized over and over and over again.
Now, Dillinger had plastic surgery done so that he could move around undetected. I can't imagine them trying to suggest that Johnny Depp needed any plastic surgery.
No. About a month before he was killed, he had plastic surgery. And it changed his appearance, though probably not enough that he couldn't be recognized. He dyed his hair, he wore glasses, he grew a mustache. He did what he could to change his appearance. And then, really, that last month was very, very much out in public.
So he didn't have to keep on sneaking around because he didn't look like the man on the wanted posters.
He thought he didn't have to keep sneaking around. I suspect he was recognizable and certainly was recognized by the FBI. There's some reason to think that people didn't turn him in who recognized him. partly out of fear, probably, partly out of, by this time, Dillinger in some ways, for many people, truly is a folk hero. His ability to escape, one journalist calls him the Houdini of the outlaws, and there's this sort of game that's being played, even as it's a very dangerous game, this game being played about staying ahead of the authorities.
Now, how do you explain some of the weirder legends, like the one that his penis was cut off and kept in a jar of formaldehyde in the Smithsonian?
That begins in 1934 with a morgue photo of Dillinger, where perhaps it was his arm in rigor mortis. Something is under the sheet covering him that makes it look like he has an enormous erection. And that photo was quickly pulled, airbrushed. When it goes out again in the newspapers, it's a different photograph. But that's out there. I think it's more metaphorical, though. I think finally this notion is that Dillinger had to have a big one. This is a, pardon the expression, ballsy guy. And I think that's how his story is seen. That's
and many showgirls went to view his body at the morgue.
Yeah, some really quite remarkable photographs of it's a very, very hot day, the day he dies and the subsequent days, but women in very scantily clad walking by the body in the Cook County morgue.
Now, the film of Dillinger and your book have come out in the midst of a great economic downturn, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Depression. You think that's just a coincidence? I mean, when you started writing this biography, you couldn't have known that we were going to be going through the kind of crisis that we're going through.
No, I certainly couldn't have. My 401k would be doing a lot better right now if I had known that. I think to tell the Dillinger story, you have to tell the story of the Great Depression. I think that's how we understand it. That's certainly how Americans understood it in the 30s and have continued to. It's also how the story has been understood in popular culture. In the last film about John Dillinger, the 1973 film Dillinger by John Milius, stars Warren Oates, and the Great Depression is front and center. This particular film, Public Enemies, was all of the filming was done, everything but the editing was done before the crash. And I think that shows up in the movie, the Depression is not front and center. This is more of a gangster movie than an outlaw movie. Dillinger, I think, in the 30s is seen more as an outlaw figure than a gangster figure. Gangster movies are always about corruption from within. Gangsters are always kind of mirror images of capitalists with guns, that sort of thing. Outlaws are on the outside throwing bricks, and I think that's more how Dillinger is seen in the 30s and probably the more common way he's seen ever since.
So 75 years later, how do you think we should remember Dillinger?
Oh, God, that's a very good question. I think we should remember him with all the complexity that we remember him, that 12 people died as a result of his depredations, and people were hurt, and that should not be forgotten. At the same time, the context in which he goes after banks, the anger that people had then as now, should be remembered, that is one of the things that makes him heroic. And finally, also, I would add, this is the great American road trip. This is about that old notion of flaming out and dying young before you had a chance to mix the metaphor, die on the vine.
Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One, is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much, Elliot J. Gorn, for talking with us today.
Thank you.